This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a geologist tells us how earthquakes reverberate through the earth and how seismology is helping to uncover what lies at the center of our planet. First, a central Wisconsin food pantry has grown into a hub for social services and community. The Abbotsford Area Collaborative Team distributes food. It also connects hundreds of families to health care and other services. And its leader says he's meeting more families every week who need help. Rob Mentzer reports.
Any IKEA in Abbotsford or no?
It's about 10 degrees in Abbotsford. Outside St. Bernard's Catholic Church, the Reverend Tim Odenhoven is talking with a man who's waiting in line for the food pantry. The man doesn't have a winter coat.
You enter like this in a basement, you take a much amount of
Odenhoven tells the man he's welcome to go down to the church basement and pick out one of the coats there from the donations pile.
You have a look in this seat, okay? Todos para ustedes.
Take what you need, okay? They're all for you. Odenhoven is the priest at St. Bernard's. For the last 3 years, he's also led the church's food pantry. Every Thursday, they distribute food to about 230 families in the rural central Wisconsin region. Odenhoven says the food pantry was initially a pandemic response.
We grew very quickly from the onset. I mean, it started maybe with 30, 40 families, with the federal aid boxes, the farm-to-family boxes, and then it just mushroomed to where we're serving 100, 150 families and 200 families. And the 230 we're at right now, it's going to go up from there.
Unemployment rates in Wisconsin have been at record lows. But Suzanne Becker says food pantries across the state have seen demand increase. She leads the Eau Claire-based Feed My People food bank and says many clients are people who have jobs.
Maybe they're the two parents who are working and they're paying their bills, but there's nothing left over at the end of the day.
The United Way has focused on the challenges of these families. They have incomes above the federal poverty line, but below the expenses of rent, food, and childcare. When the price of groceries or gas goes up, they feel the pinch.
There's no wiggle room, right? That's what we have seen. We've seen all kinds of families finding themselves in need for the first time.
Now, food pantries across the state are bracing for a new increase in demand. That's because in March, about 400,000 Wisconsin families will see a reduction in their food share benefits. During the pandemic, families received at least $95 per month in additional benefits from the federal government. In December, Congress voted to bring those additional benefits to an end. In Abbotsford, some families have another challenge. About half the population here are Latino immigrants, and many don't have legal status. Odenhoven is not Hispanic, but he's worked to build trust in the Latino community. He preaches two Spanish-language masses each week. He says he speaks more Spanish than English every day. And that wasn't the case when he came to Abbotsford 12 years ago.
It was very hard. I started speaking pretty much no Spanish, and back then, most of them didn't speak any English. Of course, that's changed over 12 years now, as the people have been here longer. So we were all kind of new together. A lot of people had just arrived at that point, so it really was we're all in this together.
The food pantry has also partnered with H2N, a Wausau-based organization that promotes health equity. Isis Vidal with H2N has been coming to Abbotsford each week for more than 2 years. She and others help clients take care of health care or transportation needs. Vidal immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico more than two decades ago.
Now I know how those people feel, you know, like when they don't know when they are new in town and they don't know who can help them.
On a tour of the church, Odenhoven opens a confessional door.
This used to be a confessional. It's no longer.
It's filled nearly to the ceiling with boxes of rice, dried beans, cereal. He says operating the food pantry has been eye-opening.
I do believe that there was a need that we just didn't notice before. And it was that unheard need. And that's the problem.
Odenhoven is making plans to expand the kind of support residents can get through the church. This spring, the Family Health Center of Marshfield will be opening a permanent health clinic in the church's basement. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, six Republican-led states and two individuals are challenging President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan at the U.S. Supreme Court. In August of last year, Biden announced his plan for anyone making less than $125,000 a year. It would forgive $10,000 to students with federal loan debt, 20,000 students with that debt who had a Pell Grant. 26 million borrowers applied since then, but the loan forgiveness may or may not happen depending on the Supreme Court's ruling. The court heard arguments in that case yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping comes out of this case? Do you have questions about what's at stake, what the Supreme Court is reviewing in this challenge? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Caspers, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, director of the university's Center for Constitutional Studies. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start us off by telling us why this case ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court? What are the basics of this challenge?
Yeah, sure. Well, the case itself is it basically raises two questions. One of them relates to whether or not the executive branch has the power to implement this plan. And the plan itself is based off of what's called the HEROES Act, which HEROES there is an acronym standing for Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students Act. That was passed after 9/11 to make changes to student loan programs during emergencies. And that program was actually used by the Trump administration in 2020 to suspend student loan repayments and interest accrual because of COVID-19. It's now being cited as the law the Biden administration is using to forgive student loan debts, as you mentioned earlier, in some significant amounts. And so that is what is the basic challenge from the plaintiffs in these two cases before the court, is whether or not the executive branch was delegated that authority by Congress. There's also the threshold question before that one, which is whether or not the plaintiffs that have brought these cases have legal standing to actually challenge the legality of the program in court.
Let's get to that. What did Congress authorize here? Question. I want to listen to Justice Brett Kavanaugh talking to Nebraska's Solicitor General about that HEROES Act you were just mentioning. Here is a listen to, I guess, a key word in the original statute.
But what do you do with the word waive? That is an extremely broad word. Why not just read that as written?
Your Honor, I believe we are reading it as written. Waive means to excuse compliance with an existing obligation, and what the Secretary is purporting to do here is to change existing loan discharge program. The Secretary is not dealing with any of these existing provisions that he purports to cite. He's not changing anything within them. He's frankly ignoring what's there and creating a brand new program, and that's not within the language of this statute.
That's the word waive, W-A-I-V-E. How much hangs on, Eric, what Congress meant by that, the breadth of the authority that they were trying to give the executive branch, the presidency here?
Well, yeah, on the substantive question of whether or not this authority was delegated by Congress to the executive branch, the meaning of that word waive, or how the Supreme Court interprets that word, there's a lot that would hang on that. The exact language in the relevant statute there in the HEROES Act says that the Secretary of Education can waive or modify any statutory or regulatory provision applicable to student aid programs when necessary in connection with a war or other military operation or national emergency. And so yesterday there was some significant back and forth on what that word waive means. The position that was taken by the U.S. government, by the Solicitor General's office, is that waive can, if you waive something, for instance, if you're waiving a requirement, it can, you know, negate something entirely in terms of that requirement. And so the argument from the federal government is that this is exactly what Congress was contemplating, is the ability to waive those financial obligations by borrowers entirely. On the other hand, what you saw from the parties raising the lawsuits is that the use of the word waive and modify, they were arguing, was chosen very carefully by Congress. Congress did not say cancel or cancellation. And so if you want to read it in the sense that Congress didn't say cancel, it didn't specifically deal with what's being characterized as discharging this obligation entirely for a certain amount of borrowing, then this is not authorized by the statute.
Brand.
Part of what it really comes down to, which we can get into now or later, is the U.S. Supreme Court in some of its decisions, especially last year in a case called West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency. It clarified what it means when it discusses what's called the major questions mm-hmm. doctrine. And with that doctrine, the court says that Congress has to speak clearly if it wishes to assign an agency decisions of what the court calls vast economic and political significance. So because of those past decisions, there's a real question as to whether or not the court will let this program stand, because it is one of these vast economic programs dealing with hundreds of billions of dollars.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tina is with us in Lake Geneva. Tina, hello.
Hi. So I just really feel sad for this generation. My son voted for Biden specifically on this premise. He applied for the $20,000. He was told that, got an email saying that his application was accepted and it would be approved. And then another email shortly after saying, oh, wait a minute, not so much. So I think it's a fraudulent premise. I think we all knew from the beginning of its inception what this was going to be. And I don't think it's fair now after the fact to say, oh, wait, no, wait, don't wait. To get hung up on semantics of wording. I don't think that's right. I think it's just not fair.
Tina, thanks a lot for the call. Eric, the semantics of the wording could have a big impact on Tina's son and other people applying here.
Yeah, it could. And, there is, on the one hand, kind of the big policy question. And there were, of course, a significant percentage of the population that supports this plan. But even if the program is popular, part of what the courts are going to look at if something gets filed as a case like this is whether or not everything was done procedurally correctly, and whether or not, again, when the executive branch takes action like this, whether they were authorized to do so by Congress. It's certainly, as the Solicitor General was arguing yesterday, the word waive can be interpreted in that way to authorize what was done here. But sometimes it will come down to, the justices, if they want to be very textualist about it, it's not uncommon for them to, look up these words in the dictionary and to use the definitions there to kind of guide them as to how to interpret the meaning of that word.
Thanks for the call, Tina. We're talking to Eric Casper, political science professor at UW-Eau Claire. Look at the U.S. Supreme Court hearing yesterday on President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the U.S. Supreme Court to approve this plan or reject it? Do you think that whatever you think of the policy itself, do you think it's a case of a president overstepping their authority? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Eric Casper, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, with us to talk about a court challenge to President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in that case yesterday. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your thoughts. Eric, I want to give a listen to another justice. This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor, talking about the possible impact of turning back on this loan forgiveness plan.
The evidence is clear that many of them will have to default. Their financial situation will be even worse, because once you default, the hardship on you is exponentially greater. You can't get credit. You're going to pay higher prices for things. They are going to continue to suffer from this pandemic in a way that the general population doesn't. And what you're saying is, now we're going to give judges the right to decide how much aid to give them.
And it sounds, Eric, like Justice Sotomayor is leaning toward that argument that under this HEROES Act, this constitutes an emergency measure that would give the executive branch this authority. What do you make of that?
Yeah, she was. And it's an argument that was also being made by the Solicitor General, because that's one of the requirements in the HEROES Act, that this would be for a war or some sort of national emergency. And the argument in that regard is that, and this was the exact language used by the Solicitor General, it was a once in the COVID-19 is a once in a century pandemic. And in that regard, more than a million Americans have died from it. Many more have been hospitalized. And with businesses being shut down and people being put out of work and unable to pay their bills, that the argument is that, well, the Heroes Act was written to deal with just this sort of national and even global emergency. And so therefore, the Secretary of Education can implement this relief plan. The plaintiffs in the case were saying, well, if there was a national emergency, that, you know, we're at the end of that. And so therefore, even if there was the opportunity to use this act earlier during the pandemic, that delegation was limited to a time when you really have an emergency that is ongoing. And if we're no longer in what the administration would characterize as a national emergency, then the plaintiff's argument is that, well, the ability to implement the Heroes Act to do something like this, that time has passed.
Let's go back to our callers now. Betty is with us in Delavan. Betty, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, you're talking about this forgiveness of student loans. My son worked hard as a busboy, saved $10,000 of his tips and his pay to pay for Madison first year by himself, and then he paid cash the rest of the 4 years. So should he get some payback for that? It's silly. You go to school, you take out a loan, you pay your loans back.
Betty, thanks for the call. This has been a policy argument about this, Eric, but I think it also came up in the court hearings yesterday, the idea of, is this unfair to people, as Betty's son did, paid their way through college, or to people who don't go to college at all?
Yeah, that came up in two different ways yesterday. One is that one of the two lawsuits was filed by borrowers who either had loans held by commercial lenders, and therefore they were not eligible for any of this relief, or they weren't eligible for the full $20,000 because they didn't receive a Pell Grant. And so at least those plaintiffs were arguing that, look, we have loans, we're not getting them forgiven, or we're not giving as much that's being forgiven. And that was the kind of the basis of their lawsuit challenging the legality of the program. There was also, during oral argument, a statement that was made by Chief Justice Roberts. He was questioning the fairness of the student debt relief when there are other people who have taken out loans for other purposes, such as to if you wanted to start a business and those loans weren't being forgiven. There was a little bit of pushback on that in terms of, is that an argument about the legality of the program versus there being a policy argument? But on the initial threshold question of standing, whether or not someone whose loans are not eligible for this relief can even bring the lawsuit, that was part of what was discussed in front of the Supreme Court yesterday.
And staying with thanks again for that call, Betty. Staying with standing, the states involved, there are questions about, well, do they have standing? What was the argument there?
Yeah, the argument there came down to largely this Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority, which goes by the acronym of MOHELA. It's a state creation to hold and service student loans. It's kind of a quasi-independent entity. And so the question there is, well, is it connected to Missouri enough so that, you know, the state can file this lawsuit on behalf of this MOHELA or this type of state-created authority? The states obviously were arguing that they did have standing. The Solicitor General's office on behalf of the federal government was saying that, no, I mean, the MOHELA and these types of agencies, if they have their own ability to file a lawsuit, then they should do that on their own and not have the states doing it for them, because, I mean, the states aren't the ones who are suffering the real injury. Now, the interesting thing about that is even the Solicitor General's office admitted that if this other entity, this MOHELA, for instance, would have standing if it sued, then that could lead to either potentially the justices overlooking the standing issue because of the inevitability of MOHELA just coming back and filing its own lawsuit as its own entity rather than having the state do it for them. So if they were to rule against the states having standing, it wouldn't necessarily be the end of the case. And it could be back in courts.
Time for one more caller. Carol is with us in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hello. I was thinking about the word waive, and couldn't they ask the senators who passed the law, since they're probably still living, and the congressmen what they meant by that word?
Carol, thanks for the call. And Carol points us toward a great question to close with. Eric, justices at all levels have to figure out what members of Congress meant when they wrote legislation. Is it as simple as going and asking them, or what?
Well, not at the Supreme Court level. You know, potentially, you know, calling someone as a witness in a trial level situation. I mean, that's not unheard of if they were connected to getting the legislation passed. And there's actually a disagreement amongst the justices and in the legal community, you know, how much stock should you put into legislative intent as far as going back to the records in Congress to see what they were saying in floor debate and what they were introducing while they were debating the legislation versus just looking at the text as it's written and then, you know, using other sources to try and interpret that language. But to that point, the justices could, when they go back and decide how they're going to handle this case, in their opinion, they could go back and cite some of the things that were said in the House or in the Senate when this legislation was being debated.
Carol, thanks for that call. And Eric, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Casper, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, director there of the Center for Constitutional Studies. He joined us today to talk about challenges facing President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday on a lawsuit challenging that plan. A verdict, a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, not expected till spring at the very earliest, possibly not until this summer. If you have more questions about what this all means, what it might mean for you individually, let us know and we can try to figure out those answers for you. You can email anytime, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you are feeling ready to get out into the garden, a little antsy with the last month or so of winter-like weather, you are not alone. And you can do it even if you don't have your own yard to put a garden in. Join a tour of community gardens around Wisconsin and find out how to get involved. Plus, share your own stories if you've been part of a community garden in your own neck of the woods. Join that conversation. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, an infectious disease expert shares advice on how not to get norovirus. Now, what will we find at the very center of our planet? Our understanding continues to evolve with some new research about the ways that earthquakes reverberate through the Earth. When I learned about the planet's layers, I thought of the Earth as having four: a thin rocky crust, then a mantle underneath that can move the crust around. Beneath that, you got an outer core of liquid metals, followed by a solid inner core. But hang on, scientists from Australian National University say they've confirmed a different layer at the very center of our planet, almost 4,000 miles down from where we're standing, or sitting. Eva Golos is an assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. Eva, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about how researchers used earthquakes and the waves they sent around the world to figure out what is at the very center of the Earth?
Yeah. So what seismologists do when they're studying things like the deep earth structure is actually pretty similar to medical imaging. So if you've ever heard of or ever had a CAT scan or an X-ray, it's similar to that. So we have seismometers, which are instruments that record the shaking from earthquakes. And wherever an earthquake happens, if it's strong enough, the waves can travel all around and all through the center of the Earth and can be sensed in that seismometer. So we can do a bunch of different signal processing to figure out what that structure is. But the deeper you go, the deeper you want to look, the harder it is to find those waves that pass through the center of the Earth. So that's one thing that makes this study really cool.
Is it a matter of, you know, if we've got more seismometers around the planet, we can start to get better and better deep readings like that?
Yeah, exactly. One of the big problems with that is that it's a lot easier to put seismometers on land. So we're a little bit limited on where we can place our instruments, but there are more efforts to instrument the oceans as well, which is exciting. But even with data that we already have, there's always new ways to look at it and new ways to use what we have to learn as well.
So what is this telling us is at the very center, the core of the core, I guess?
I guess at the center of the core is another core. So the study gets, I would say, a little bit technical in this regard. So some of the layers, for instance, the mantle versus the core, are very different in composition, in state. The outer core is iron and nickel. It's liquid, whereas the mantle has a different composition and is more or less solid. The inner core is all solid. It's all iron. The difference is really the structure. So it's mostly iron. And what scientists noted was a property that we call anisotropy. And what that means is that waves that travel in different directions through a medium will travel at different speeds. So what the authors of this study noticed was that waves that travel through the outer part of the inner core are faster in one direction and slower in another direction. And that same thing is the case in the innermost inner core, but that direction that they travel quickly, more quickly in, is different in the inner core. So it's sort of two shells within a single layer that we can study using these really powerful seismic waves.
Now, you also do research based on seismic waves. I think you've got projects going in Alaska, for example, where they have more earthquakes than we do here in Wisconsin, which is part of why I'm in Wisconsin. What kind of work, what are you, and you're looking a little further up than the core. What kind of things are you looking for?
So my area that I focus on is in the crust and the uppermost part of the mantle. I really look at the scale of tectonic plates. We call that layer the lithosphere, which is the rigid layer at the surface, and that is composed of blocks that slide around and interact with one another. So we can use, I would say, a similar approach to this study of the core to look at the mantle, but we use different waves that don't travel quite as deep. And we can put seismometers in different places and look in significantly more detail. We're not as dependent on having these very unique ray paths. So what I'm doing in Alaska is I actually placed 11 broadband instruments with the help of some of my colleagues. What broadband instruments mean, they're seismometers that can listen to events that happen all over the world. They're powerful instruments. And they are right now sitting in the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska, a little bit south of Anchorage. And they're just listening and recording data constantly. And then we'll go there in May again, once all the snow has melted, and uncover our instruments, because some of them are buried under the snow, and take a look at the data. And what we're trying to do is image this layer of the lithosphere in greater detail. Alaska is a place where it's really important to understand that structure, because there are very large damaging earthquakes that can happen there. And we need to have a good picture of what the structure is in order to understand how shaking might happen in response to one of these big earthquakes.
So with a better map that you're hoping to generate with this gear you're going to dig out of the snow, we might be able to say this area might be more under more of a kind of threat than we might have thought previously based on the things we're seeing?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's the goal. That's the hope.
That I could see that being very practical. Getting back down to the core of the Earth, now I understand this is raising questions or maybe adding insight into why we have a magnetic field on the Earth and some about how our core formed. What kind of questions there sound interesting to you?
Oh, tons of questions. The core is super interesting, and you're totally correct that the core is ultimately the engine that drives the Earth's magnetic field. And really key to that is the outer core being liquid. You have liquid iron swirling around inside the outer core, and that ends up generating a magnetic field because it conducts an electric current. And so that is really the process that's responsible for the electric field. However, the outer core is slowly cooling. All of the Earth is very slowly cooling. And slowly the liquid outer core is starting to crystallize. It's starting to freeze because that liquid iron is getting cold. And that's what's forming the inner core. So the fact that we see a structural change in different portions of that frozen inner core might indicate something really interesting about the history of the Earth. You know, what kind of processes might have enough power to really change something at the very center? That's, I think, a really interesting question. Would we be able to make predictions about something we can test on the surface to better understand this process? Some people who are more familiar with the core might have interesting ideas about that, but I think it's a fascinating and important area to study in our planet.
Eva, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep, thank you so much.
That's Eva Golos, assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. She joined us to look at new research that supports the theory of a solid metallic ball at the center of the Earth's core, a core of the core. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about pizza.
According to Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, mozzarella is the most popular cheese in the U.S., and Wisconsin producers make more of it than anyone else. As Jana Rose Schleiss tells us, a lot of that mozzarella ends up on pizza, making Wisconsin a leader in frozen pizza production as well.
In a manufacturing facility just off the interstate in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, more than 30 employees work in unison on a production line that churns out one of the state's growing exports, pizza.
So today we're doing our Brewpub Hardy Artisan. So it's a little bit of a thicker crust, which you can tell.
Matt Salvig is the advertising and promotions manager of Bernatello's Foods. He's showing me around their massive frozen pizza factory. Bernatello's produces different pizza brands, including Orv's, Roma, and Brewpub Lotsa Matza. Marketing manager Adriana Freilich has been with Bernatello's for years, spending her summer breaks as a teenager working on the production line. She explains just how fast that line moves.
So we can go from anywhere from 60 units a minute to 180 to 200.
Each unit is one pizza. That's...
Yep, a lot of pizzas.
A large digital tracker on the wall shows that 25,000 pizzas have been made so far today. The pizza making starts in the bakery, where dough is rolled out and pizza-sized circles are cut. Just like when you make Christmas cookies, the leftovers are collected and put back into the machine to roll out again. After the crusts are baked in massive ovens, they're placed on a rapidly moving production line where sauce is dropped on top, followed by the cheese and other toppings. Wisconsin's frozen pizza industry is big and growing. Along with Bernatello's, national brands like Tombstone started in Wisconsin. There are also countless small shops. So what makes Wisconsin the frozen pizza capital? Pizza pairs great with another Wisconsin staple, beer, and many of the state's frozen pizza brands started in taverns. It might also have something to do with Wisconsin's long winters. The numbers support that claim. Bernatello's sells more frozen pizza from November to March. Back on the production line, Selvig and I get a glimpse of the ingredient that helps the frozen pizza industry thrive.
And here's where it all happens, right here, cheese.
20-pound blocks of mozzarella get cubed, shredded, and waterfall onto the pizza speeding down the line underneath. Wisconsin is practically synonymous with cheese. We make it, we eat it, we study it.
Let's say a cheese manufacturer would send us shredded cheese, and then we bake it on a pizza and tell them how it performed.
Mark Johnson is a scientist with the University of Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research.
Did it melt? Did it stretch? What was the color of the blisters? How many blisters it formed? What was the chew characteristic? What was the flavor?
The research done by Johnson and his colleagues helps producers develop a cheese that fits the needs of the frozen pizza manufacturers. Johnson has seen the frozen pizza industry in Wisconsin expand.
I started here 40 years ago. A frozen pizza was like your last resort.
That's no longer the case. According to the American Frozen Food Institute, people in the U.S. ate 1.4 billion frozen pizzas last year, making it an over $6 billion industry. Johnson says there's a big reason frozen pizza businesses have thrived in the state.
We just have this culture in Wisconsin. We make cheese, we make the best cheese. You got to make the best pizzas, right?
Looking at the production line, Frelick remarks on how much has changed since she first spent her summers making frozen pizzas.
This is light years beyond where they were.
And Bernatello's has no intention of slowing down, helping secure Wisconsin's place as the frozen pizza capital.
Gianna Rose Schleiss brought us that story on pizza production in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, it's norovirus season, and an infectious disease doctor gives us advice on avoiding the winter stomach bug. That's next here on Central Time. Now, norovirus cases are on the rise. The CDC says that although cases are higher than this time last year, about 17% compared to about 15%, still within the expected range. But in some parts of the world, the gastrointestinal ailment has spiked. In the UK, cases are 66% higher than the average for this time of year. Norovirus is most common between November and April, usually peaks in the winter. We're talking about the current state of norovirus and what we can do to avoid getting it. Dr. Joseph McBride is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He treats complicated infections in adults and children, as well as infectious diseases related to organ transplants. Dr. McBride, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us the basics? What is norovirus? What can it do to us?
Yeah, the basics. You know, lots of times when we talk about different germs, we really go into the details of what the organism is first when we're describing it. But with norovirus, it's really best to get right to what the symptoms are, and because everybody really has their own norovirus story or recollection that they have. What norovirus is it's a really contagious gastrointestinal virus that comes on quickly, usually in a matter of hours to a day or so after an exposure, and really ravages people with nausea, vomiting, fevers, body aches, chills. It goes away. For most immune competent people with healthy immune systems, it leaves oftentimes as quickly as it comes. But what it leaves is this really strong memory in people's mind about, boy, I remember that time I had that terrible gastrointestinal episode or stomach flu or outbreak at a certain center. And so people usually keep that memory with them for a while.
To what extent is it really a seasonal pattern of illness in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So like you mentioned it as the winter vomiting disease. Traditionally, it was thought of been really around November to April, like you mentioned. But we can see it throughout the whole year. And we'll call the ones in the summer kind of sporadic cases. Where we see the most episodes are during these winter months. So just like you might get a cold or flu season, we think of in the wintertime, but you can still get those things come summer. I would put norovirus in the same category.
How does it spread, this norovirus? And this is a little gross, but go for it.
Yeah. So norovirus is really an incredible virus because of just how easy it is to transmit from people to person to person, and also just how hardy it is. So just like you kind of alluded to, the most common way of it spreading is what we call fecal-oral route. So this would be someone who's got fecal matter on their hands, and then whether they then shake somebody's hand, touch a doorknob, cook food, this then gets spread to other individuals. But because norovirus is so hardy and so really resistant to kind of normal things like sunlight and temperature fluctuations, it can really stay on surfaces for a long time. And we call this fomite transmission. And, you know, I think we are a little bit heightened about these types of transmission in the setting of COVID these last few years. But this would be where you've got a viral particle that has been deposited on something and then somebody else touches it. And you know, I think for listeners to hear just how kind of potent and durable these norovirus particles are, things like freezing it does not destroy the virus. Temperatures as high as 140 degrees Fahrenheit do not destroy the virus. Things like alcohol hand gel and different kind of alcohol-based cleaning products do not destroy the virus. And it can last on surfaces I mentioned for days. And so if you've got somebody in a setting of a big outbreak where it's running through a house or a college dorm or a cruise ship or a military barracks, you can really see how it's so easy for this to be transmitted around. And in fact, there is even reports of it being airborne after people throw up. So it's the idea that they're throwing up, the virus is up in the air, and it could be inhaled in that way. And so it is a very, very tough virus to avoid in the setting of a high outbreak situation.
I'm hoping you have some advice for us to help us not get and or spread this thing.
Right. Yeah. So the biggest thing is kind of what we've always known about is soap and water. So unlike those alcohol hand gels, this would be a situation in which I would really reach for soap and water over an alcohol hand gel, which are wonderful for a lot of respiratory viruses like COVID, but again, not for this. So if you're in a group of people where you could be touching a lot of things, I would always err on the side of soap and water. And if you happen to be a parent or a loved one caring for a sick individual with gastrointestinal symptoms, nausea, vomiting, be sure to use soap and water as kind of your cleansing habits. And similarly, if you were cleaning a bathroom, let's say of a symptomatic individual, bleach products, diluted bleach in water would be superior than kind of a lot of alcohol-based home cleaning products.
Okay, so oh no, we got it. What's the home care advice?
Yeah, diet it out is pretty much the best advice that we can give. You know, for somebody who's immune competent, healthy immune system, this will be a miserable few days. Most people are symptomatic for about 48 hours, and a few are a little bit longer than that, but you will get over it. Where people do run into trouble is when they are having such profound vomiting and diarrhea that they become dehydrated, in which case you really have to be sure you're keeping up with your fluids, especially in situations where you're not keeping stuff down. And if you find yourself in that situation and you're feeling like you're lightheaded, then going out to seek medical care for maybe the need of IV fluids. Where we in infectious disease oftentimes see a lot of norovirus patients is in situations where maybe there is an immune compromising condition, like a solid organ transplant recipient or somebody with HIV or AIDS. And in these situations, symptoms do not oftentimes abate so quickly, and they can be persistent for weeks and months. And that is a really challenging thing because we do not have good antivirals to cure the infection.
And Dr. McBride, I mentioned, you know, this disease, it's here now. It's not in alarming levels in the United States at this point. What do you watch for to see if it's going to be a bad norovirus year?
So there actually are national networks that track norovirus and other foodborne illness outbreaks throughout the country. The one specifically for norovirus is something called Norostat, which the federal government and CDC follow. And these are investigators who essentially go around and ask the questions of why did this large cohort of people get norovirus at this school or this hospital or this institution? And what they're able to do is follow numbers in many different states throughout the country to kind of give us a good sense. And here in Wisconsin, at least, I will say that the levels these last couple weeks are coming down a little bit from their high in early February. So we're hopeful that maybe we've weathered this storm and we'll be looking for, you know, smoother pastures, greener pastures in the next few months.
Dr. McBride, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Joe McBride is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He talked to us about norovirus. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a bill in Congress would add 150 seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, that bill's a long shot, but we'll find out why has the House been stuck at 435 while the population keeps getting bigger. And the origin of COVID-19 is still hazy. There are a lot of unanswered questions about where it originally came from. We'll find out why it's such a tough question to answer. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.